Good afternoon. This is a rebroadcast of a two-part program, first aired in early 2006. Part two will air next week.
Scholastics, a strong work ethic, and team sports are the foundations for an exuberance of artistic talent. Stay tuned. Hello, this is Stephen DeLuque, and you are listening to Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program dedicated to the advancement and exploration of the visual arts. Today, we begin a two-part program on the philosophies and life experiences of painter Marvin Hardin. Marvin was an instructor at various Southern California institutions of higher learning, topping off his distinguished teaching career with a mere 30 years at Cal State Northridge. Mr. Hardin's works are part of numerous private and public collections, and he just closed a retrospective at the Armory in Pasadena. Co-host Krissa Hewitt and I met with Marvin at his studio located in the coastal mountains overlooking the Pacific Ocean. As you will now hear, many of Marvin's diverse life experiences helped develop the tools necessary to build his life's goals.
Good afternoon, Marvin.
Hi, how are you?
And Stephen?
Good afternoon.
We're sitting on top of the world, it feels like. This is in what little mountain range?
Well, these are the Santa Lucia Mountains and the coastal range, California coastal range.
Now, if we backtrack a minute, you and I met when I was your student at Cal State Northridge in 1970, probably.
Well, you might know better than I.
Well,
I don't remember. It's a long time ago.
I graduated in 71, so I had to have had your classes prior to that. So, sometime in there. How is it that you happened to find this beautiful neck of the woods?
Well, it's an interesting story. I wanted to live in a country setting, and I did down in Southern California, but it began to be too much development, so I wanted to leave.
Too little country.
Too little country. Mm-hmm. I came up here with a couple of friends of mine, and I had been in this area, and I loved this area. And I wanted to make sure that I got within 5 hours of Cal State Northridge so I could drive back and forth. And we came out to this this road out here, and there we were parked in front of that gate that you guys came into. And it was a beautiful day, a beautiful sunny day. And we were looking out to the ocean, and the ocean was all glistening in the sunlight, and the mountains, or, you know, the ridges were, you know, undulating towards the sea. And I said to my friends, this is the kind of place I want, a place with a view like this. And 2 days later, my lady friend found a two-line ad in the L.A. Times, and it mentioned the road. And so she called the guy up, and she said, does it have a view kind of like coming in low in an airplane? And he said, well, I guess you could say that. So that was a Friday. We came up the next day, and it was right through that gate and right here, and I bought it on the spot, and I didn't even prove water. I said, it has to be, and it was like magical. And here we are, and it cost us a fortune to finally find water. I mean, like 11 holes.
We
had to
drill.
Yeah, it's pretty difficult to find it, you know, because it could be coming through in a little stream someplace underneath, and you've got to find that that little stream. So that's how it happened.
And then you were building up here, but you were commuting on a weekly basis.
I was building up here, and I had to sell my house down south. I had this place that was a couple of acres, but it was like thousands of acres because nothing was around me. And I was up in the foothills, not in the foothills, but I was in the Santa Susana Mountains down there overlooking San Fernando Valley, the west, northwest corner of the valley, the Chatsworth area. And I had to sell that place because I needed the money, and I had to rent a place. And I lived in an apartment for a year, which I'd never done before. I'd never lived in an apartment before. So I lived in an apartment and had this started. So I got one wing of the house started while down there. And at the end of that year, came up and lived in that one half of the house, the half that had the bathroom, of course, mm-hmm. and then started building the rest of it.
So now you're here, and now you're retired, so you don't have to make that commute on any regular basis anymore.
No, I don't have to make that commute. I made that commute for 10 years. I taught at Cal State Northridge for 30 years, and I taught 5 years before I got there at various institutions. I started as a TA at UCLA and taught in the extension program at UCLA. Mm. Taught at Harvard College and at Santa Monica College, all of which was part-time. I was a lecturer. I had a regular milk route. I was going from one place to another. And it was great because, you know, there are no politics when you mm-hmm. teach like that. You just go in, you teach your class, and you leave. And you don't get involved in all of that nonsense that often happens in the academic world.
Where did it start for you? Where did the art part start in your life?
Well, I drew as a child. Sometimes. I didn't do it, you know, all the time. I wasn't that kind of kid. I was more athletic and more adventurous than sitting around drawing. But I did draw, and I started so young, I don't even recall when I started. You know, it seems to me I've been drawing ever since I've got into this world. But I only drew with pencil and pen and ink and stuff like that, and I never painted or did anything like that because, you know, we were poor and we lived in a terrible part of the country for black people.
And where was that?
In Austin, Texas. It's a beautiful little town, mm-hmm. but at that time it was a Jim Crow state in those days. Mm-hmm. So I drew, you know, off and on whenever the spirit hit me. I guess I was about the fourth or fifth grade and sixth grade. I used to draw the holiday scenes on the homeroom blackboards in pastel. You know, Christmas scenes and Thanksgiving mm-hmm. scenes and stuff like that. I was the official person for that. So I did that.
A step up from blackboard eraser monitor.
Yeah, a little step up from there, you know. I could do that while the classes were going on, so I had a kind of a special kind of situation there. And believe it or not, I also used to deliver. I had a bicycle. I rode my bike to school. And I would deliver the receipts, the money, mm-hmm. from the lunchroom program across town on my bike, hanging in money bags from strings, you know, the money bags that had the drawstrings, mm-hmm. hanging on my handlebars. And I know that's difficult to picture today. The little kid would be going across with several money bags hanging on the bicycle. But I used to do that. I did that for from the fourth through the sixth grade. I was also captain of the safety patrol. Now, what the safety patrol was is Russian guards, mm-hmm. but they were all children. Mm-hmm. You know, I was the captain, so that meant I assigned people to their stations, and I also had a station that I could choose my own station. But that's indicative of the times, you know, that mm-hmm. you would have children doing those things, mm-hmm. and it was, you know, good experience.
When I went down to the opening of your exhibit in Pasadena at the Armory, as I was walking around looking at the pieces, the word that kept coming into my head was disciplined. Do you have a response to how that fits in your life, even as being the monitor for when it started?
I think that, you know, it's indicative within what I just told you, that as a young child, I was given responsibilities. And apparently, I was always good at, following through on whatever the responsibilities were. I went to, obviously, all-black schools. There were three elementary schools. They were all black in Austin at the time that I was there, and one junior high school and one high school. The junior high and the high school were like a block apart, not like they were a block apart, less than a block, really. The significance of that is that when I graduated from elementary school, I think in May, in August, I was playing football on the football team with all high school kids. I was the only junior high school kid on the team. And that happened kind of like a freaking timing. Mm-hmm. Just as I arrived in junior high, the coaching staff initiated a junior varsity and made it possible or invited the junior high school boys to come out for the junior varsity. And I was the only kid in junior high that took them up on it. So I played junior varsity football in the seventh grade, and I was 126 pounds, and I was 12 years old. And all the rest of the guys were high school kids. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the first season, three guys on the team were promoted to the varsity, and I was one of the three. And so I was on the varsity of the high school team at 12, a full year before I got to the high school. That's kind of like my life evolved. I was always ahead of my time, especially athletically. I was very gifted as an athlete. And the same kind of skills that manifest themselves through drawing or painting, or the same kind of skills you need in part to hit a baseball or to throw a baseball or a football or catch a football, or whatever, all those things are hand-eye coordinated things. And so I was always very good at that stuff.
Did you focus on art when you were in junior high and high school?
I focused on art when I got to college.
You did?
Yeah, I had no clue about art. If there were museums in Austin, I didn't know about them. Mm-hmm. Because, in effect, Austin was two cities, two towns, so to speak. Black people were circumscribed in, you know, in a ghetto, as mm-hmm. it were. Growing up there, I didn't have any clue about art or museums or, you know, any of that stuff. And when I got to college was when I first got to that point where I was interested. Mm-hmm. I was an honor student throughout my years in school, and I liked everything. I liked all of the subjects, liked all of my courses. So when I got ready to choose a major, I simply chose a major, obviously out of ignorance. I didn't want to do something that didn't permit me freedom. Mm-hmm. And so I chose to be an art major because I thought it was something that would give me more freedom than maybe some other discipline, some other field, something else, you know. I could have just flipped a coin, so to speak, because I really did like other things.
So that college door was open to you. Was it something that, assuming by the description of the segregated Austin, was it expected
To
go to college?
No, not necessarily. I was the first in my family to go to college. I had two older sisters. They were much older, one 8 years older and one 10 years older. It wasn't necessarily expected of me, and we were poor. But I was an outstanding athlete, and I wanted to go to college to play football. And I wanted to go to UCLA to play football. And I wanted to go to UCLA because I was a high school tailback. I played other positions also. I did all of them, you know, I played defensive halfback, mm-hmm. and I ran back punts, and I ran back kickoffs. But my principal position was an offensive tailback, and we ran from a formation called a single-wing formation, and you don't see anyone doing that anymore. It's an old formation. But there were two major schools that ran from that formation, and that was Tennessee, University of Tennessee, and UCLA. And, of course, Tennessee was a segregated school. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to go to UCLA in part because of that, in part because Jackie Robinson had gone there, and he was a hero of mine. I had lived in California before when I was very young, and my folks had come out to, you know, make a better living, be in a better place to live. How it ended up that I ended up at UCLA.
And you did play football?
I played football at UCLA briefly. I had played football in high school, in junior high and high school. 2 years of semi-pro after that, a couple of seasons at LACC. I had to go there because I went to a separate but equal school system, and I needed to, even though I was an honor student, I needed to fulfill a lot of requirements that we didn't have at the schools that I went to. Then I went out for football at UCLA, and I got hurt before I got to UCLA. I started having dislocations of my left shoulder, and it became chronic. And so I had to either have surgery or quit. Mm-hmm. So I decided to quit.
And I'm assuming that at that point, then the interest in art had started to rejuvenate planted.
I was already an art major, but then it began to be more of a central focus for me.
Did you attend UCLA on an athletic scholarship?
No, I was a walk-on.
You were? Okay.
I was a walk-on.
Yeah.
But you don't get a lot of of recruiting. You didn't in those days.
No.
Down in black high school.
No.
in Austin, Texas. But I tell you, somebody who went to Austin, my same high school, is Night Train Lane. I don't know if you've ever heard of that guy. But he started out as a Ram for the L.A. Rams, needless to say, when the Rams were in Los Angeles. And he set a record. He was a defensive halfback, cornerback, they call it now. He set a record for pass interceptions. I think it's 14, and that was in 52, and it still stands. Mm-hmm. He's considered the greatest at his position.
Yeah.
So he went to my high school, and the irony is that when he was playing, I was in elementary school, and he was a friend of my youngest of my two older sisters. So when I came out to Los Angeles for the second time, I was looking at the Rams, and it was the first time I'd never seen TV before then, mm-hmm. really. And I was looking at the Rams, and of course I became a Ram fan since it was the local team. And there was this guy that was making plays all over the place, and they were talking about Night Train Lane, this Night Train Lane, that. And I, you know, it was just Night Train Lane. I had no clue that this was the same guy that I was a fan of when I was in elementary school. Because when he was in Austin, he had a nickname of Q-Ball. They started calling him Night Train on the Rams mm-hmm. because he used to play a record all the time. It was like Night right. Train, it was a song.
Right.
So anyway, I discovered this Q-Ball and Night Train was the same guy. It was quite interesting. I was a fan of his, you know, when I was a little kid, when I was still in elementary school.
You are listening to Ears on Art. We rejoin painter Marvin Hardin as he further defines his teaching and creative philosophies.
I'm going to go back to the word discipline just because it was amazing how it just stuck the other night when I was looking at the work in what I hope is the most complimentary of terms, not something that
is... Oh, I think it is complimentary. I take it as that.
Good. Because the work is just so involved with detail. Obviously, the listeners can't see anything right at the moment, so we're always in that position of trying to describe something to them. One of the series that you know that I've really been fond of for a long time was a series of relatively small paintings that you were doing of birds. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about those a little bit? And I mean, my fascination with this was as much with the individual images of the bird as it was with just the whole treatment of the background. I mean, making this piece of paper just look almost like a rusted piece of metal by the time you got done with it. And it would have been edible if it were edible.
Well, I don't know what I could say about it. You know, I don't talk about my work. I have a philosophy that precludes doing that. I believe that the work is what it is, and that my talking about it is a whole other is. It's not the
I
same
understand
thing.
That. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and one of the things that I firmly believe is that when an artist talks about his or her work, what he or she says becomes gospel because they're considered the authority on their work. And if I say to you or anyone that this is that, it means such and such, or I do it such and such a way, then I preclude the kind of possibilities of reading that anybody else might bring to it. And there are multiple possibilities. And each person comes to the work prepared by their own history, by their own preferences, by their own feelings and so forth. I don't want to cut that off, nor do I want to insult anyone's sensibilities or intelligence or anything of that sort, because I believe people are capable of arriving at their own thoughts about the work. So I don't, I avoid talking about it directly other than to say what I just said, which is a philosophical point of view.
On that philosophical point of view, at least it seems to me it's part still of philosophy, mm-hmm. how have you helped students, do you think, over the years expand their ability to see?
Well, I stress that, particularly in beginning courses. Obviously, as you well know, I'm sure, that there is a different approach, at least it was for me, of teaching beginning students as opposed to advanced students and graduate students. Beginning students really are involved in the whole fundamentals of picture making, and you have to deal with it on this kind of elemental level for them. And seeing is a very important aspect of it. And part of that aspect is to make the students understand that their abilities inherent in the use of their senses, the tools, the highway, as it were, to learn and to express themselves. They have to be able to gather information, and they only have their senses to do that. And so they have to learn to see, and seeing in terms of how I'm using the term, means bringing their senses to bear, all the senses that can be used in a given situation, not just your eyes, but your imagination as to how something would feel, even if you can't touch it, and what it might sound like if you thumped it, or whatever senses you can bring to bear to get to know whatever it is you're trying to know, to understand that that's all part of the process of creative growth, and to further understand that one is surrounded constantly with all kinds of stimuli, and we need to, as sensitive people who are supposed to somehow interpret or reinterpret, we need to gather information and place it in our storehouse, and we can conjure it up whenever we need it and make adjustments, twist and turn it, and somehow make it meet whatever ends we need it to meet.
My memory is that when taking a drawing class from you, that assignments often involved statements about if we were doing some aspect, let's say, of a self-portrait, that what I remember your admonishment to us was, one, I want you to take hours, mm-hmm. and two, that when I'm talking about, this is you speaking, drawing your face, that you could spend hours on 2 square inches and really look and see what a freckle is, or, you know, hair follicles or things like that, that even though I didn't do that very well, it has stayed with me as an aspect of recognizing that what we look at all the time, we often don't see.
And that's correct, yeah. Well, you know, when I taught those classes, whether it's beginning drawing or beginning painting or beginning design, what was most on my mind is to imbue the students with what I consider the truth, and that is that if you're going to grow, if you're going to do something to the best of your ability, and I don't mean just a particular thing at a particular time, like a particular drawing, one drawing, you want to do that to the best of your ability, but you also have to understand that that one drawing is a stepping stone to future drawings and future paintings and jewelry or whatever it is a person makes. And if we're going to be at our best, then we have to take it seriously, and we have to really spend some time looking and some time making decisions about what comes after this decision and what comes after the next decision and so forth and so on. And the whole idea behind it is simply that if you're going to be any good at anything, it's going to be difficult, perhaps, to be the best that you can be. And you can start out, it seems to me, blessed with a lot of skill, but you can still be better. But in order to be better, you have to work at it. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think part of that comes from having been an athlete. Because when you're an athlete, particularly, I played baseball and softball and basketball and ran track and played football. But particularly in football, sometimes you thought the coaches were trying to literally kill you. You know? I mean, those guys were really tough. And so if you were not a tough kid, you weren't going to stay out there. Not only because of the coaches, but also because of the other guys, you know. It's a rough sport. And if you were a shrinking violet, if you couldn't take it, you were not going to stay there. So I learned very early that if you wanted to do something, if you thought it was worth doing, you have to understand that you have to be capable of dealing with it when it gets tough, not just when it's easy. Anybody can do it when it's easy. You know? But it's not, you know, you want to separate yourself from the average person, in a sense, that you want to be able to be the best that you can be, and hopefully that best is one of the best. In other words, you want to be one of the best, right, among your peers. And that was my attitude about it.
Well, thinking about the correlation with sports, too, that when you go out and you have a really good day at something, it was your day to intercept all the passes or to make all the proper blocks or to catch all of the passes thrown to you or to run, you know.
Like Kobe Bryant.
Yeah, like Kobe Bryant last night with 80 points.
81 points.
Yes. 81, excuse me. And that you take that 81 point, or you take, you know, Chamberlain's 100 point, you know, night, And those don't then become the next night 82 and 101. No. So that ability to ride the roller coaster and to know that in sports or in art, we never know when the best is.
No, you never know. You just have to, you have to be a prepared person, I think. You know, you have to be prepared because you're not completely in control of your own life. You're not completely in control of your own destiny. I think I can't quote it, but I'm trying to think of what John Wooden said, and John Wooden is a former coach, right, basketball coach at UCLA, a legend in his own time, believe me.
Right.
He said something about luck is the residue of preparation. I think that's how it goes. Mm-hmm. And I subscribe to that.
As I mentioned toward the beginning of the program, I was a student of Marvin Hardin's. Actually, twice. I took a beginning foundations course in two-dimensional design, and then I took an intermediate drawing class. The decision to come back for a second time was not one based on, oh boy, this will be an easy A. Far from it. Even then, I knew that drawing was not my forte. But I also knew that working with this instructor was going to ask a great deal of me. I wish I could say that I had put out the effort that he expected. I learned very quickly that I could never fool him, that last-minute drawing resulted in the D that it deserved. And when I did put forth the effort and the time, he knew. I didn't have to run up and say, oh, I spent so many hours on this. He just knew. He could tell. And that was great. The fact that I remember many of the assignments given in those two classes taken in 1970 probably says the whole thing. I cannot say that about a good deal of the rest of my education, even in art classes. It was a special treat to be able to have this conversation with him this many years later. A network search of Marvin Hardin, H-A-R-D-E-N, will produce a few examples of his work and some written essays about him. The image quality falls far short of doing justice to his art. However, with the help of having just heard Marvin's thoughts, I hope that you will be able to see a little bit more than what is there. Part 2 of this rebroadcast of our conversation with Marvin Hardin will air next week. And something new for the new year. An art exhibit entitled The Phantom Project has an open call for entries for 2- and 3-dimensional work. Pieces are due January 28th. The Phantom Project relies on vacant urban retail space that has been donated for the purpose of the exhibit. This one will be up for a full month in downtown San Luis Obispo. For further details, please contact Ron Roundy at 805-235-4808.
You have been listening to Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program produced here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio. This is Stephen DeLuque, and for co-host Krista Hewitt, thank you for listening.